exception to renormalization. So just to begin, we can consider a theory that we're quite familiar with at this point, phi 4 theory. And we'll just look at a pretty simple example considering a one loop vertex or one loop Feynman diagram. And when we are looking at a diagram like this, we can write the integral describing this as, excuse the fact that I'm going to eliminate some factors and it's going to be a very rough approximation, but just to give you an idea, it looks something like this. And when we actually want to solve this, we have to get it just in terms of the momentum. And you end up getting some result that looks and you say, oh, our result goes logarithmically. And now, that seems nice, but the purpose of doing this is actually to compare it to experimental results for scattering amplitudes. And in order to do that, you need limits. So when we put the limits in, you notice right away, this isn't going to work very well if we integrate all of, over all of momentum or energy. So we can define this, because we like to define things. That's a problem. So this is kind of where the motivation for we need some way to get rid of these divergences. And before I explain the sort of the first step to getting rid of them, we can look at why we have divergences. So it would be really, really nice in 5-4 theory if we could just consider sort of one vertex. That would be great. You'd have incoming, outgoing momenta, some coupling constant g. But experimentally, that's not what we see. You see every possible higher order diagram as well. So you would actually see something like a mess of loops where you're measuring a coupling constant G physical. And this coupling constant sort of accounts for all of these. There are two possible analogies you can use to see why you can't actually measure this bare G. So one would be if you have a sphere in fluid and you want to measure its inertia, you have to take into account that as the sphere moves, it's also going to drag some fluid with it. And another example that you might be more familiar with would be charge shielding, which is the same idea. You can't measure the bare charge. So we can see now we have a problem. We can see why we have this problem, and now how do we fix it? So the first attempt would be, okay, the problem here is that we have an infinity. So how about introducing something that gets rid of the infinity? So we can introduce a cutoff, which we call lambda. And this cutoff, in this case, would be physically meaningless, although you'll see an example later on where it can actually be a more meaningful parameter. And by introducing this cutoff, we can then perform all of the calculations, and then afterwards we'll take cutoff to infinity. And by doing this, it's called regularizing UV divergences. So that's something we've heard several times. And so doing this, we introduce the cutoff. We actually, we'll see later on that as you go into deeper into the renormalization, you actually end up eliminating this term using counter terms, which Grisha will describe in more detail. So I'll just make note of that. And so that's sort of the first step. And then another thing that we see a lot with renormalization is something called running coupling constants. And this is just the fact that when we do an experiment in physics, you actually perform it at a certain energy scale. So say you have some experiment one, And in the course of this experiment, you measure some G physical. And then you want to do the same experiment, but you do it somewhere else or at a different energy scale. So called experiment two, you measure a new G physical. And this is fine, except the physics should be the same at these two energy scales. So to do that, so physics is the same. And what we get out of this is that the coupling constant will actually scale with energy. And you can see this more in the beta function and in flow equations, which both Jacob and Paulina will discuss. So this is sort of an initial idea of what we do with renormalization, and it actually can go, it goes much further than this, and you'll see that in the next few presentations. So now we'll have Grisha describing counter terms.
Okay, so I'll illustrate one particular method of renormalization, namely renormalization using contour terms. So on the example of FIFO theory, as usual, we start with a Lagrangian, and our Lagrangian is a kinetic term. Let's emphasize that parameters in this Lagrangian are not physical, like mass and scattering amplitude, but some initial bare parameters. And like using this Lagrangian, we already can start doing perturbation theory expansion and calculate amplitude using Feynman diagrams. But the problem with this perturbation theory is that even in each term of perturbation series, you will have divergent terms, divergent integrals. We want to deal with this somehow. And we know that by dimensional analysis in four-dimensional space, the degree of divergence of an amplitude with n external legs is 4 minus n. So when we look at this theory, we see that we have three types of divergent amplitudes. Like first is just the correction to vacuum energy. And the second is a renormalized propagator. And the third is amplitude with four legs, like scattering of two particles into two particles. So this doesn't really enter in any physical quantities we want to compute. And this, if you look here, it diverges as like cutoff squared if we use the cutoff regularization. And this scatters as logarithm of lambda. So basically, three divergent amplitudes gives us three infinite constants. We want to deal with them somehow. And the method we will deal with them, we absorb them into parameters of a Lagrangian. So what we do is first we know that the propagator has a pole at physical mass. Here plus some regular terms like regular at pi squared equal to m squared. We want to renormalize the field in such a way that the residue at this pole is unity. This will give us one infinite constant. The other two will be like physical, the difference between physical mass and scattering like parameter of interaction or like four-point function scattering amplitude. So now we define. Dz equal to z minus 1, dm equal to like initial bare mass z minus m squared, and d lambda equal to lambda 0 z squared minus lambda. And now we want to rewrite our Lagrangian in terms of this renormalized field, physical mass and physical lambda, and those three parameters that will correspond to free terms, which we call contour terms. So the way our Lagrangian is written now, it is like the initial Lagrangian, but we've expressed through term, through field phi r. Okay, and also we obtained three other terms. Okay, so this is like what looks like the initial Lagrangian, but in terms of this field, and these terms will give us new Feynman rules. So the new, in addition to the old Feynman rules where we had the propagator, we had a four particles interaction. We also obtained new type of lines. This comes from these two terms. And we obtained new type of vertexes. Okay, up to now we just made a trivial rewriting of the initial Lagrangian. We want to make a physical sense out of it, so we impose what we call renormalization conditions. Namely, we require that space here. We require that the full propagator has a pole at physical mass. In fact, this is like two conditions. One condition is the pole is located at M, and the second is that residue is 1. And the second condition is that full four particle like 4, 2 into 2 particle scattering amplitude is equal to its physical value at like in the center of mass of particles. So Mandelstam variables are as following. Okay, now we can describe a procedure how to compute amplitude using this method. Like first we take those parameters as unknown and compute those two amplitudes to the order we want, and we obtain the expression like, and we use some method of regularization, dimensional or with a cutoff, and we obtain expressions for these parameters from these conditions, and regularization enters these expressions. Now we want to compute some amplitude, and we compute it using these new Feynman rules, using the same method of regularization, and in the final answer, the regularization disappears. It doesn't depend on the regularization. Okay, so now Jacob will present another method of renormalization, namely Wilsonian renormalization.
Yes, okay. So there's a slightly different way of viewing renormalization, which is called the Wilsonian approach, or Wilsonian renormalization, which introduced by Ken Wilson, and he tells you that the cutoff, which we have been discussing, so if we have the energies, and some cutoff at high energies, this is actually a physically meaningful thing, which every theory comes with some scale where it's valid. And above this scale, the energy, the theory doesn't work. And the problem is that if we do an experiment, we're far below this cutoff. So say we are here, some energy, and we do experiments. We don't really care about all the physics here. And so we want some way to systematically see how the physics look at a lower energy scale. And that's what renormalization is about in this picture. So what we do, and yeah, I should say that this high energy corresponds to short length scale. So this kind of means that maybe we have some graininess of space from quantum effects or in condensed matter and StatMech, as you will hear later, this would correspond to like lattice spacing. So what we do is that we say up here at this energy, the field is just, if we have the field as a function of momentum, at these higher scales, the field is just zero. At above, we split it in, below the cutoff, we split it into two different fields. This field is something here and zero here, and this is something at low energies and zero up here. And we rewrite our Lagrangian in terms of those two things. And then we look at our path integral formalism, where degrees of freedom are the variables of integration. So we can write, if we have our normal expression with our cutoff, we can write this as two integrals over the high frequency and the low frequency fields. And then we can try and integrate out the high energy physics, kind of average over all the things that we don't care about. And if we do this, we can do this by seeing this as an action of two fields and using diagrammatics and perturbation expansions to find a new so-called effective action. Which one did I have down? Which is then a function of only the low energy field. So we start with some action up at the cutoff scale, and we do this, and we find this effective action. An interesting feature is that this effective action, even if we start with some, say we start with the 5-4 theory, this effective action will have all possible different interactions in it, even those that are non-renormalizable, such like phi to the 6 or d phi to the 4th or all other kind of things. So this might seem strange and bad at first, but as we will see, the approach kind of takes care of that in itself. So we want some way of systematically getting rid of all the degrees of freedom down to the scale we're interested in. So what we do is we pick some small number b, which is smaller than 1, but pretty close to 1, and we just integrate out this part. This ensures us that perturbation theory in doing this integration will be valid. And then we want to compare this to the original action. So this will give us a shift. If we start with the 5-4 theory, doing this will give us a shift in the parameters that's already there, and it will also introduce new couplings to all these other possible interactions. So we do this, we compute the effective action, and then we rescale our momenta like this, which kind of sends this cutoff back to the original one so that we can compare. And if we take B to be infinitesimally close to 1, and we do this over and over again, we get a continuous change in our different coupling constants and the mass. And this continuous flow in the parameter space is what is called renormalization group flow. And it's not really a group, I have to mention that because of the name, because we can only go in one direction. We don't have any inverse transformation. And if you analyze how the parameters change in more detail, you can arrive at flow equations. No. Oh, well, almost worked. If you do this in more detail, but it's in practice easier to use the counter terms together with the renormalization conditions. But this gives a picture of why we have this flow. But if you do it in more details, you arrive at flow equations. So for a coupling, you get an equation something like this. Where this is the famed beta function, which describes how a particular coupling G flows when we change the energy we look at. And Paulina will tell us more about how this flow works and what it tells us.
So I'm going to explain a little bit about how can we classify our coupling constants. So, and why? Why do we want to classify them? So imagine we have a physical observable, which depends on the energy scale and on the coupling constant. So if the dimension of this physical observable is alpha, we can do an expansion. Where these are dimensionless quantities, considering that the dimension of the coupling constant is m. So in order to see if our perturbation expansion is accurate, we have to know what this dimension of the coupling constant is. And then we can see if this will be accurate for low or for high energies. So remembering that the action is dimensionless, we can do as we have done in QFT1, QFT2, and in several times. We can calculate the dimension of the operators, where our generic Lagrangian can be written in terms of the free Lagrangian plus couplings operators, right? So in four-dimensional spacetime, we have that the dimension of our coupling constants will be 4 minus the dimension of the operators. So as we can calculate this, as you can all remember, we have this. So if this dimension is greater than 0, we call it relevant coupling constant. If this dimension is less than 0, we call it irrelevant. And if it is 0, we call it marginal. Now, why do we call them like this? Well, if we go back here, we can express our coupling constants like this, where this is dimensionless, right? So this, for example, can be G1, blah, blah, blah. So as we go towards large cutoffs, which is the same as going towards the infrared or the low energy region where we are carrying our experiments, when this is positive, this will become more relevant in our Lagrangian. When this is negative, we will just discard it. And when it is marginal, we have that. It's not depending on the cutoff. So, well, this was just a naive dimensional analysis, but if we want to consider quantum corrections, we can go and use what Jacob already explained us of E beta function. So considering quantum corrections, we can do the same thing. If the beta function is negative, that means that the coupling constant is becoming less relevant as we flow towards, as we flow towards the infrared. So G will be relevant. I have defined it like this. Right? If it's positive, then it's irrelevant. If it's zero, then we will have a fixed point. So, for example, we have our RG flows. If we have a relevant coupling here in the space of parameters, flowing towards the infrared, we will have that G1 is becoming more relevant and G2 is becoming irrelevant. And as a last example, in the lecture we saw the example of a potential considering phi 4 interactions in the phi 6 term. So doing this dimensional analysis, which I just erased, we can see that this is an irrelevant coupling constant, and this is a marginal. But using the Wilsonian normalism, we can get an RG flow like this. So here, if we didn't know anything about dimensional analysis and we did our flow equations, we could see that if G is greater than zero, then G is, okay, marginally irrelevant. It is becoming less and less important as we flow towards the infrared. If G is less than zero, then it is marginally relevant. And for example, in this case, in this region, we can see that H is irrelevant. So and now Hendrik is gonna present us how we can see renormalization in statistical mechanics.
So I'll do some examples that we've talked about in statistical mechanics.
And it was actually Kardanov himself who introduced the topics I'm going to show to you now. And it was later generalized by Wilson introducing the renormalization group flow, as Jacob talked about, and Paulina. In the Wilsonian renormalization, we started with a maximum energy cutoff, or not cutoff, maximum energy, and we averaged out our degrees of freedom to some physical energy scale, mu. In statistical mechanics, we'd like to think about distances instead. And we start with a minimal distance, the lattice parameter, and average out our short distance degrees of freedom to some length scale. There are several ways of doing this averaging. In a 2D icing model, we have this lattice with spins. And under a renormalization transformation, we reorganize these into blocks and define a block spin, which is the average of these spins. Then these block spins themselves will form a new lattice, like this. In the 1D nearest neighbor icing model, which we looked at quite a lot in statistical mechanics class, we instead had this chain of spins, called in sigma I, and we averaged out every even indexed spin and kept the others. And we call the new ones for mu. The actual averaging is done similarly to what Jacob talked about here. We take the partition function, which is the sum over all configuration, e to the minus beta h of k, where k is the coupling constant between two neighboring spins. And we attack this by doing some parts of the sum first. So we split this by sum over mu and sum over the even sigmas, e to the minus beta h of k. And we showed in class that this could actually be rewritten as a constant times the sum over mu, e to the minus beta h of k prime, a new coupling constant. And we here got a relationship between k and k prime as a function of k, which we'll here call R2. Mark is going to talk a little bit more about that later. If we now do this step several times, we will get the flow of k. And if we start with, say, k equals 1, and plot is versus the step, or the length scale, because every step we take, we kind of zoom out larger length scales, it will look something like this. So this is the flow for k, or rather, we would draw it like this. It goes down to zero. We see that at a large length scale, the coupling constant acts as a weak coupling. And we would say that the corresponding operator is an irrelevant operator. For the 1D nearest neighbor icing model, we also talked a lot about correlation functions between spins n sites apart. And we related this to something we call the correlation length, xi. After a little song and dance, and we also did this in our homework or maybe tutorial, we got that xi equals minus a over logarithm of tan k. under a renormalization transformation, we took A to A prime equals 2A and K to K prime. And it can be shown by inserting our expression for K prime we got into this expression for Xi, that Xi prime is then Xi. This is a general result, by the way. If we come to a fixed point in the renormalization flow, that is, we still have A goes to A prime equals 2A, but now K goes to K prime equals K instead. We get that just from this expression, the Xi prime equals 2 Xi, but this should be Xi itself. This means that Xi is either 0 or infinity. I'm going to call the first one a trivial fixed point, and the second one a critical fixed point. So for a critical fixed point, we have infinite correlation length. And since we are at a fixed point, we also have scale invariance. And we can see this as the fluctuations of our state occurs at all length scales. And now Mark will tell us about how the critical fixed points of the renormalization flow is related to the critical points of our phase diagrams. Mark.
Okay, so as Henrik mentioned, I'll be talking about basically the role that RG flow plays in understanding phase transitions in, I guess, condensed matter. And I guess in general, I won't be concerned about how we actually do the renormalization, just that we get a flow. In fact, Henrik just introduced what's called the block spin renormalization. And in the statistical mechanics book we were given, there's this wonderful line where it says something like, Kadnaugh's block spin renormalization is right in spirit but wrong in detail, which which I thought was pretty funny. So nonetheless, I'll have some general renormalization gadget, which I'll just call R. So I renormalize by some length scale L. So I'll just call that my renormalization gadget. How it's done isn't relevant for this discussion. So then, of course, fixed points are pretty clearly those points where that are invariant under the renormalization gadget. Once we have a fixed point, we can introduce something we call, well, I'll call it a basin of attraction, but in essence, it's all the points in our phase space that flow into the fixed point. And there's kind of an implicit assumption here that all fixed points act like sources or sinks. So all of our integral curves on our phase diagram begin and end at fixed points or diverge to infinity. So we don't have any like closed loops or any kind of weird things you can get in dynamical systems. It's kind of a simple diagram. And most reasonable physical systems work like this. So given a fixed point K star, I can define what I'll call the basin of attraction associated to that fixed point, which is all of our coupling constants, so that if I iterate my renormalization gadget an infinite number of times, I eventually end up at our given fixed point. Then the reason for introducing this notation is that because of how we've defined our renormalization group flow, we've always set it up so that physics is essentially invariant under the renormalization flow. So all, for all points in the basin of a given fixed point, the physics is identical as it is at that fixed point. So we can use the fixed points to kind of classify the different types of physics that are described by our phase space. And I guess the reason why physics is the same is these conditions of fixing the particular physical amplitudes, like the demanding that the physical mass is fixed for the two-point correlator and that the scattering amplitude is what you see in experiment. So the conditions we build into the renormalization flow fix the physical or the important physical things. So I'll just leave a comment at K in the basin, same as K star. So now they say that every good talk needs one proof. So this will be ours. I have a theorem which says that if the correlation length at a fixed point K star is infinite, then every point in its basin also has infinite correlation. And I guess the importance of this kind of statement is that we'll see that we can use the fixed points that have infinite correlation length will give rise to what they call critical manifolds, which are basically the surfaces along which phase transitions occur. But first, I'll demonstrate why this is true. So my proof. It's in fact incredibly easy. So we know that, as Henrik said, the correlation length is fixed under renormalization group flow. So if you renormalize something, the correlation is the same. So that means the correlation of K is the same as the correlation of renormalizing K once, which is also the same as doing it well n times. I apologize if it's hard to read. So then if we take the right-hand side to infinity, we get that this goes to the correlation of K star, which we know by assumption is infinity, which implies that this is infinite. So now, why is that important? It allows us basically to say that our trivial fixed points are the things that actually describe the bulk phases of our system, where critical fixed points are the one that describe the surfaces along which phase transitions occur. And I'll kind of demonstrate that by an example, simply because I know it's probably hard to actually prove completely. So let's just put a line here. Someone loves Mills, but I don't know what to say. So I'll pick an example of a model pretty similar to one we've looked at in class, but complicated enough that you actually have an interesting diagram. And it's going to be the icing model with nearest neighbor and next to nearest interactions. So we have something like this. Spin 1, spin 2, sorry, I and J, with some other coupling constant. And I'll just write next to nearest neighbor as N, 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 because I have no desire to actually enumerate these things. And it turns out, I'll kind of just recall the result because I don't want to, I have no idea how you'd find it. But this thing has four fixed points. There's one here at the origin, which is trivial. There's also one somewhere along, or sorry, I should say what these things are, K1 and K2. There's also one down here, which is not trivial, critical. There's another one here, which is critical. And there's one somewhere around here, which is critical, but I'm going to do that since I need more room on the diagram. And the flow lines are something like this. This point, these two flow into this one. And they also flow this way. There's a line, this one flows to here, then flows off to infinity. And then in here, they kind of all flow back towards the origin. So since this point has, or sorry, since this one has infinite correlation length, we know in fact that every point along this line has infinite correlation length. So, thank you, Henrik. I'll color this in, because this is actually acts like a phase transition, because on both sides, the correlation length is finite, but as you cross this line, your correlation length diverges, which is a pretty clear sign of phase transition. And then we have two separate phases. We have one here, which is described by the physics at this fixed point, and one out here, which is described by the physics at the fixed point at infinity. So that's kind of a picture of how you can use renormalization group flow to understand phases. It's actually really cool. I'm surprised. Well, you never know. And I guess you can also use this, if you remember at the beginning of our condensed matter course, Joma talked about how, first of all, conformal field theories are like fixed points of RG flow. That's kind of obvious from our discussion over here. But I also made this, or said that that you can use conformal field theories to understand all quantum field theories. And this picture kind of helps you at least get an intuitive understanding why. Because if you imagine that you have this giant phase space of all conformal field theories, so you have an infinite dimensional space with all your different possible couplings, then the fixed points, and now you can imagine this is some very large statistical mechanics type system. So then the fixed points of this can be used to classify the phases of conformal field theories. And I guess this would, since ones that lie in the same basin would have the same physics, you can actually kind of understand all quantum field theories by looking at the fixed points, because at least near the fixed points, they'll have similar physics. And he made this statement that most quantum field theories are perturbations of QFTs by relevant operators, which you can kind of see on this diagram, because relevant operators, if you go through the analysis, would be these curves that come away from fixed point, sorry, that flow away from fixed points, while relevant ones are ones that flow in. So you can kind of, once you're at a fixed point, you can kind of perturb away and end up in the whole phase space just by doing perturbing by a relevant operator. So thank you very much.